Srimad Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Ki Namane Namaste Sadasati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Vishesha Srimavari Paschachade Satarani Umagyanam Timurandasya Garanjana Sulakaya Chaksurum Yuritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpa Tribhyastra Kripa Sindhu Bhirbhaja Vatitanam Bhavane Vyo Vaishnave Vyo Namo Namaha. So this evening, I thought we'd just look at a very short little line from the Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to look at, here it is. In chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives a long list of all the different items or elements of knowledge. And here's one of them that shows up. This is text 9. Janma, Mrityu, Jara, Vyadhi, Dukkha, Doshanudarshanam. This means that anudarshanam, that one observes or one sees the evils, the faults, the problems, the difficulties, dosha, of janma, birth, mrityu, death, jara, old age, and vyadhi, disease. Now, it should strike us as a little weird that these things are listed as items of knowledge, because doesn't everybody know about these things, about birth, death, old age, and disease? Maybe we don't think of birth as a really terrible thing, but in the view of the Bhagavad Gita, there's transmigration of the soul, and after you die, you're born again, and that's not a good thing, because you keep going through the same thing over and over and over again. This is called mrityu samsara, the circle of repeated birth and death. It's not nice. So these are considered to be the really evils of life, but we see people are being born all the time. We see people growing old. We're not growing old ourselves. Somebody is. People are becoming diseased all the time, and people die. It's a very common thing. Yet, somehow or other, there's something about recognizing these evils. I want to read a little bit in the purport to this. Prabhupada comments on this line. He says, one should try to understand the distress of accepting birth, death, old age, and disease. There are descriptions in various Vedic literatures of birth. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the world of the unborn, the child's stay in the womb of its mother, its suffering, and so on, are very graphically described. So he goes on a little bit about that. Sometimes we have been told that in the womb of the mother, everything is great for the child. The Bhagavatam says it's not so much fun. And being born is not very pleasant either. So he describes these sufferings of birth. Because we forget how much distress we have suffered in the womb of the mother, we do not make any solution to the repetition of birth and death. Similarly, at the time of death, there are all kinds of sufferings, and they are also mentioned in the authoritative scriptures. Then Prabhupada says, these should be discussed. And as far as disease and old age are concerned, everyone gets practical experience. Nobody wants to be diseased. No one wants to become old, but there's no avoiding these. Unless we have a pessimistic view of this material life, considering the distresses of birth, death, old age, and disease, there's no impetus for our making advancement in spiritual life. So, the first thing to recognize why this list is there. If you ask most people in every country, what is your biggest problem? These things don't tend to show up. In America a while ago, there was a survey, what are you most afraid of? And at that time, in the place the survey had taken, it was, number one was unemployment. And then death was like number 15 or something. But that's revealing. Because if you say, why are you afraid of losing your job or not having a job? Well, if I don't have work, then I won't have any money. So what's the problem with not having any money? Well, then I won't be able to eat. Well, what's wrong with not eating? Well, then I'll die. So you see, it's really the death problem. But he's not thinking about the death problem. He's thinking about what I can do to get a job. If there's something I can do to solve the unemployment problem. Go to school, or vote for the other political party, or something, you know, we can solve this problem. But really, at the heart, is the death problem. And we can say, what solution do you have for the death problem? That we don't like to think about. These things are listed because, actually, no matter what you do in this world to make things nice for ourselves or secure a nice future, even if we have lots and lots of money and great friends and live in a wonderful place and we've done everything we can for it to be nice, wherever you go, there's birth, there's death, there's old age and disease. So if one wants to be happy, I have to solve this problem. I have a disease problem right now, small sort, courtesy of... Ram Sundar came to our meeting in our farm, and the whole national council who was there now had a scold.
I'm getting better.
Yeah, he's getting better. I'm getting worse. I've taken his karma. No. So, you have to excuse me. So that's why these are considered problems. That when it says if you really want to be happy in this world, solve the disease problem. Now, you know, people are working on this. They always have been, as long as it's been the human race. And I was promised when I used to read when I was a young kid, you know, that well, you know, we've gotten rid of certain diseases and now we're going to get rid of the others, and now there's a war on cancer, and just around the corner, you know, we'll have solved the problem. And yet, now that I've lived to what's, you know, old age, at least the beginning of it, the old diseases that were banished are coming back. Multiple drug resistant tuberculosis and all these other things, and so many things resistant to antibiotics, and then there's brand new diseases, AIDS and Ebola fever and Marburg virus, the emerging diseases, and it looks like it's still going on. Oh yeah, we've had our big industrial revolution, and so people are not dying of cholera and typhus and diphtheria. No, we get to die of cancer and heart diseases, which has sort of changed the diseases. That's what's happened. And of course, there's the old age problem. People are spending a lot of time fighting that. My city of Philadelphia is not far from New York City, and so I read the New York Times newspaper regularly. I get it delivered at home. And There's always discussion about what people are doing to get rid of wrinkles, of Botox injections, and the latest, so many things. Everybody's doing this, and everybody's doing, everyone's fighting like crazy, getting old. And the different plastic surgeons and the cosmetic treatments and so on. And what people are going for in a big way. Yeah. It's I think right now in New York City, among fashion people, yoga comes second. This comes first. Not to get old, but of course, you know, it keeps on going. And of course, we also, medical science promises. There was in the news that they discovered that, you know, cells, at a certain point in the life of a cell, some kind of, I guess you could call it a chemical switch, yes, goes, and the cell starts to age. And this was, this discovery was announced with great fanfare. And now we have to just figure out a way to get in there when it switches. Go in that pincer. And we think we can do it. And then finally they announced that in mice, some laboratory mice, they managed to do that. But the mice all got cancer. So, as I say, back to the drawing board, you know. So, but anyway, people are still going, but they will not solve this problem. And of course, what about the death problem? What about the death problem? So the main way we deal with these, especially with the death problem, is by not dealing with it, by not thinking about it, by pretending it's not going to happen. I've got a little discussion with Prabhupada here. He mentions this. And then in Bhagavatam there's a discussion about this too, about not thinking about it. Very, very strongly not thinking about it. So Prabhupada, this takes place in Colorado. He's walking in the morning with some of his followers. Prabhupada is saying, nothing in this material world will stay. So always chant Hare Krishna. This is a very dangerous place in the material world. Padam padam yavipadam. This is a place where at every step there is danger. Right now we are walking in a very nice park. This is in Boulder, Colorado. It's a very beautiful city. The Rocky Mountains are up there. This nice place. Right now we are working in this very nice park, but at any moment there may be a revolution and the whole thing may change. The whole thing may become like fire, just as it has now become in India. This is 75, and Indira Gandhi had to put all these emergency laws and uproars everywhere. So we should remember that here in this material world, padam padam yavipadam, at every step there is danger, as Srimad Bhagavatam describes the world that way. Therefore, give up your attachment for this place. That is real intelligence. And yet the modern educational system is misleading people into maya sukhaya, making gorgeous plans for temporary happiness. That's all. If in the slaughterhouse the animals are kept very comfortably, what is the meaning of it? The disciple says, no meaning, they'll still be slaughtered. Prabhupada says, it is sure that all the animals will be slaughtered. So even if, let us say, the animals could arrange, all right, before being slaughtered, let us live very comfortably, would that be very good intelligence? Intelligence consists in inquiring, why must we be slaughtered? How to stop this business? That is intelligence. How do you define slaughterhouse? Prabhupada said, what's the slaughterhouse mean? Disciple says, a slaughterhouse is a place where many animals are said to be killed brutally. Prabhupada says, yes. In slaughterhouse, many animals are brought together expressly to be killed. So this whole material world is a slaughterhouse. And when there is a need, many two-legged animals will be brought together into a war and killed. This place is a slaughterhouse, and yet the foolish two-legged animal, you say we're just like animals who just don't know what's happening to us, is thinking, now I'm very comfortably situated. He forgets, I am going to be slaughtered. Mrityu samsara sagara, this is a quotation from Bhagavad Gita, this place is an ocean of slaughter. And this is, sagara means ocean. Krishna says, Krishna conscious devotional service can deliver you from mrityu samsara sagara, the ocean of repeated death. This place is a slaughterhouse, but people are accepting it as their home. Another name for this material world is mrityu loka, the place of death. But people are still taking it as a very comfortable place. This is their intelligence, accepting a slaughterhouse as a very nice place. When you point these things out to the animals who are going to be slaughtered, how do they respond? And this is a rhetorical question, meaning what do they respond by saying, oh, let's don't talk about that, it's too depressing. They respond by really ignoring it. Why do you take such a negative view of life, they say. But Prabhupada said, if you don't see it, so actually, the fact is the matter is, people don't like to think about this. There's a famous English poem from the 18th century actually, where the poet is observing some school children playing ball at Eton College. He's thinking of what will happen to them in the future. And he says, and he thinks, if they just knew what was going to happen. And he says, thought would destroy their paradise. And then he said these lines, which are often quoted in English, when ignorance is bliss, it is folly, it is foolishness to be wise. So many people are counting on ignorance is bliss. And so we spend a lot of energy being ignorant. We don't think about it. Because if we look at the material world without any illusions, it's like Prabhupada said, it's just a slaughterhouse. Now who can live with that? That's why Pascal, the French mathematician and also later philosopher, theologian, one of the things he said was that human beings, men are so necessarily mad, meaning insane. Men are so necessarily mad that not to be mad is another form of madness. You understand what he's saying? He says that it's mad means you don't see reality. So we are necessarily mad. We don't see reality. We don't look at it. We live in a kind of dream world because not to be mad is another form of madness. You will also go crazy if you just look at it for just a little while without any illusions or... So this is the problem. Now I'm going to read from Srimad Bhagavatam. This is from the second canto, first chapter, and this chapter is called The First Step in God Realization. So here, Sutta Goswami is talking about people who are just immersed in the pleasures of everyday life. A night, they sleep, or spend their time in sex. During the day, they make money. They're simply concerned with taking care of their families. This is how they spend their days. talking about so many things. The newspaper comes, the television is on, so they kept talking about this and that and so on. So then he says, so these people, he says, they do not inquire into Atma Tattva, that's the Sanskrit word, the principles of the soul or into transcendence. They do not, he says, persons devoid of Atma Tattva, any interest in anything beyond these things, do not inquire into the problems of life. Being too attached to the fallible soldiers, they're called here their own soldiers, sanyesu. Sanya is an army. Sanya is an army. Asatsu, meaning fallible. They will not be victorious. They can fail. They're soldiers. He calls fallible soldiers like the body, children, and wife. Deha, apatra, you could say that, you know, body, children, or wife, or husband, the other way around. And then he says, pashyan api napashyati. Oh yeah, being too attached to these, they do not see their inevitable destruction. What he says is, pashyan api napashyati. Although they see, they do not see. What it says in the Bible, they have eyes, but they don't see. So this is pashyanapi na pashyati. Although they have seen everything, still they don't see. Because they're so attached to these, my body, which is strong and healthy and can do so many things, and my wife, my children, and my friends, my... So here Prabhupada, his commentary on this verse, this is a very deep commentary. He says, this material world is called the world of death. We just heard him say the same thing in this morning walk. Every living being, beginning from Brahma is the creator, demigod, whose duration of life is some thousands of millions of years, down to the germs, who live for a few seconds only, is struggling for existence. Isn't that true? I mean, when you take a elementary course in biology, we learn everyone has this instinct for self-preservation. Even the smallest little squiggle of life, everybody at least wants to stay alive. And so this is going on, the struggle for existence. We're all doing this. Then Prabhupada says, therefore, this life is a sort of fight with material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, he says, a living being is competent enough to understand, come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence. This is what's part of Atma Tattva, to really get down to why am I in this situation, why am I suffering, why do I have to die, why do I not want to die? All these questions. So we can actually come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence, but being too attached to family members, society, country, and so on, he wants to win over, to win victory over, the invincible, invincible means you can't be conquered, material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, and so on. Although he is sufficiently experienced in the matter, by dint of past experience and previous examples of his deceased predecessor, his dead ancestors, He does not see that the so-called fighting soldiers, like the children, relatives, society members, and countrymen, are all fallible in the great struggle. One should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died, and that he himself is therefore also sure to die, and similarly his children, who are the would-be fathers of their children, will also die in due course. No one will survive in the struggle with material nature. The history of human society definitely proves it. And yet, foolish people still suggest that in the future they will be able to live perpetually with the help of material science. This poor fund of knowledge exhibited by human society is certainly misleading, and it is all due to ignoring the constitution of the living soul. This material world exists only as a dream due to our attachment to it. Otherwise, the living soul is always different from the material nature. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time. And the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles, which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, and so on. Due to a lack of knowledge of self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance, and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. Our friends, relatives, so-called wives and children are not only fallible, but also bewildered by the outward glamour of material existence. As such, they cannot save us. Still, we think that we are safe within the orbit of family, society, or country. The whole materialistic advancement of human civilization is like the decoration of a dead body. Everyone is a dead body, flapping for only a few days, and yet all the energy of human life is being wasted in the decoration of this dead body. Sukadeva Goswami is pointing out the duty of a human being after showing the actual position of bewildered human activities. Persons who are devoid of the knowledge of Atma-tattva are misguided. But those who are devotees of the Lord and have perfect realization of transcendental knowledge are not bewildered. So that's his commentary on this. So in the first place, this is certainly obvious. We are in this material world, and actually we are for some reason looking for pleasure, or we're looking for happiness. There's like very elementary things to look at. Everyone is here looking for happiness, and we get that happiness by coming into relationships, bring our senses into contact with the objects, and we feel some happiness or we feel some pleasure. But in this world, those contacts are all temporary. They have this distressing tendency to break apart. And that puts us in anxiety all the time. Even when we have what we want, we're afraid of losing it. And so we work very hard to perpetuate these relationships. Yet they break down all the time. And if we ask ourselves, if I have some relationship that's from which I'm getting satisfaction or pleasure or happiness, when it breaks, when it ends, how do I feel? Well, I feel really bad. I feel depressed. I feel, really sometimes in mourning, it just like can really affect me profoundly. So why do I feel bad? Well, if you ask anybody, they'll say, well, because I wanted it to keep on going. And then if you ask, well, how long did you want it to go on for? People will often say, well, how long can I have? Forever? And so you see our real desire is for some kind of happiness or relationship that goes on forever. That's what we're looking for. Yet we are looking for it in a place where everything is temporary. But this is an incompatible situation. Something's really wrong. Now Prabhupada is urging us to try to figure out what is wrong. Why are we here? How did we get into this situation? Another way to look at it is this. Prabhupada here mentions the struggle for existence. So we see that every living entity, it just wants to survive, you know, has instinct of self-preservation. So ever since there was life, every living being, human, animal, plant, microbe, whatever, at least this one basic thing to survive. And then if we ask ourselves, who has succeeded? Who has actually survived? You see, the failure rate is a very depressing 100%. And yet that desire is so strong. You know, we always see these stories, you know, of people surviving in a desert island or in a plane wreck, and they eat their friends and all these other things just to stay alive. You see, I can understand that. It's nasty, but so it's so powerful. And yet everything is temporary. This is an incompatible situation. Actually, we understand and then how do people deal with this horrible situation? By just for putting themselves to sleep. Here we are, we're in this dangerous situation. And it is dangerous. It's like a war. That's why these things are called soldiers. It's like a war. Because all a war is normal life a little speeded up. Otherwise, here we're in a nice, peaceful place. There's no violence going on around us. Yet if you take the whole, you know, you go out in a circle of 30 kilometers and find out how many people are dying, you'll find out that it's like a war. We just don't notice. And it's kind of kept tactfully out of sight, where you don't see. So, everybody knows that soldiers who spend some time in combat, they never come back to normal life. Because what happens to them when they see warfare and people are dying all around them, it seems to them like, now I see the way the world really is. It's like a revelation. And then when it's over, they never trust the peace. They're walking down the street and everything is nice, but they think at any minute the whole thing can go away and it's back to what it really is. And you see, they're right. We say they're suffering from a disorder. They call it in America post-traumatic stress disorder. They're suffering from a disorder. But that's only because they've seen reality. And so what is the treatment? To make them crazy. Not to see reality. That's the definition of crazy. That's the treatment. So Prabhupada is telling the right things. So a case can be made, and actually this has been made not by Prabhupada, by Otto Rank, who was started out as a student of Sigmund Freud, one of the early founders of psychoanalysis, and he thought Freud was superficial and just dealing with sex, and he thought there were more profound issues. And this was one of the things that he talked about. And so from his point of view, he saw all of human society as a kind of denial of death. Where denial, you know, has this technical use in psychoanalysis, of like where you things that you should acknowledge, but you keep them hidden. But although you keep them hidden from yourself, still they're affecting you. So he says this is denial of death, that we are always making, we are engaged in these little immortality projects or God projects. So so somehow or other we can defeat death. You know, these are basic things that people have known for a long time. You know, Shakespeare, during the Renaissance, people thought, yeah, death is going to take you, so you should have children. You know, and people said, when I have children, I have little replicas of myself going on, and even though I go down, so this is like having children is my immortality project. And other people, they like to have, at least in my country, you go to any university and the big buildings been paid for by donors who have their names on them in big letters. And this is their immortality project. And people really still, I mean, the fame is a big thing, you know, people seeking to be famous or well-known. That way they become important and immortal and remembered and so on. All these are these, somebody's got some little project going to be immortal. They collect gold. Why gold? You know what? Because gold is the immutable metal. It doesn't rust or corrode. And so it's a kind of instinctive reminder of immortality. So people like to have gold things because of, it reminds them of this. All these different little immortality projects, where you're really trying some way or another to, in some way that really doesn't work, defeat material nature. Because if we want to stay alive, if we want to be happy in this world, we have to go to war against material nature. And as Prabhupada said, it is a war you're going to lose. It will not work. So, people are wasting their lives. This whole thing is going on. We're in the middle of a war. This big momentous occasion happening to us, and we just avoid dealing with it. There's a wonderful short novel or long short story by Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Illich, about a guy, a Russian bureaucrat in the 19th century, who gets injured and finally he realizes he's dying. And everybody pretends it's not happening. Everybody, his wife, it's just an inconvenience. it's really quite, Tolstoy has it really down, you know. He's all alone, he's isolated, nobody wants to deal with it, you know. Because everybody has made this little existence. That if they just acknowledge what's really happening, the whole thing would be vanished. So, but actually, as Prabhupada is saying here, as human beings, we actually have the potential to really deal with the problem. And this is what he means by atma-tattva, or what we call self-realization. You see, we can ask ourselves about this. Why do I protest so much? Why do I want to survive like anything? Why do I want my happiness to go on forever? And the reason is because we are eternal beings. This is an incompatible situation. We feel something's wrong. We feel like we don't belong here in this material world because we don't. Because we don't. I can remember when I was a child, and I don't know, maybe sometime 2-3 years old, I'm a very, very young child. But somehow or other, I kind of woke up or came to consciousness. And I suddenly, you know, realized that I thought it was so strange that I'm here. This is me, this body that I'm in, this little boy's body. Why am I here and not over there? How did I get here? I come into consciousness and I'm in the middle of this ongoing drama. There are these people, this the mother, the father, brothers, and neighbors. And there's something that's It's like I've been dropped into the middle of a drama. And how did I get here? I mean, how did I just, what am I doing? You know, why am I here? Why am I in this family? That this one I call my family, not the one across the street. You know, I mean, I'm pretty sure I tried to ask my mother about this, and she had no idea. You know what. It was just so strange, and people say, yeah, don't. Because there's, it's just, we are eternal spiritual beings, and we belong in that world, but we are now dropped into this place, thrown into this place, where everything is temporary. We're trying to do our eternal thing. And it doesn't work out. Yeah. So this is the description and the that makes sense of all this. And it says that we can do something about this. And this is the here the term that we use for this is self-realization, and it's a very interesting expression. Because most of us, we have been trained or heard about or been brought up in one of the traditional religions. And we've heard things about the soul, and they talk about eternal life and all these other things. And I used to go to church and hear about all these things, and somehow or other it didn't really get to the point. In some ways it was dealing with reality more than what most people were saying. But I couldn't apply it. I couldn't apply it. So here, when you say the word realization, the word realization means that there is direct experience. There's knowledge. You can gain knowledge from a book. But when it's realized knowledge is when you have direct experience of it yourself. Prabhupada gets this from the Sanskrit word vijnana. Jnana in Sanskrit means knowledge. But it's kind of a theoretical overtone. But then there's the word vijnana. The prefix vi in Sanskrit is kind of an all-purpose intensifier. This takes whatever it is and makes it more so. So vijnana is used in the sense of direct perception. So when self-realization means coming to experience oneself as a spiritual being. Notice when we use the term soul a lot in the Krishna consciousness movement, but of course the Sanskrit word is atma, and atma means self. Like when I was going to church, you know, we were talking about. I had to worry about my immortal soul. It seemed to me that I was going to die and my soul something else, like some ghostly liver or pancreas or something, was going to keep on going, you know? And I thought, why should I care about that? You know, I'm going to die. So there's not quite a proper understanding that I am the soul. But I had the idea that I am a body and I have a soul, the sort of thing tacked on, you know. But it's just the opposite. The soul is atma, it's the self. And I have a body. So the beginning of self-realization, first of all, there's a little theoretical knowledge because we have to know where to look. Like a theory, or jnana, kind of gives us a map. But then you have to use the map to take the trip. If you just stare at the map, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good, you know. So the map tells us how to find or to identify the self. Because of course the basic thing is that we are covered by this illusion in the material world. We forget who we are. As I said, we are eternal spiritual beings. We do not experience ourselves as eternal spiritual beings. Because sat, the nature of our, the self, is sat, which means without any beginning and without any end. But we're not like that, you know. Look in the dictionary of famous people after their name. There's one parenthesis and a date and two dates in between, you know. This is like a birth and a death, you know. That's our existence. This contained within these two parentheses. I was born on this date, and there'll be another date at the end, and people will stick it on a stone somewhere. That's that. So we don't experience ourselves as without beginning and end. It's coming into being. Chit means also, the other characteristic is that we have full consciousness and full awareness. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know what's going on around the corner. We keep reading the newspapers to try to figure out what's happening, and we can't trust that. We don't know who's telling the truth. Our own senses deceive us, and testimony's not reliable. We sort of grope our way through the world, hoping we won't run into something bad. Our knowledge is very limited. And the other characteristic is ananda. We are full of bliss by nature. We just don't even have to look for it. It just comes bubbling out. It's not the way we experience ourselves. We are full of trouble and subject to all kinds of pain. So we do not know who we are. The basic idea of self-realization, we have to even do something to find out who we are. And this is overcome illusion. The entry level understanding from the Vedas for trying to go beyond. Prabhupada uses the term transcendentalist. Transcend in English means one who goes beyond. It goes beyond this material nature of this this body. So the basic ground level, entry level understanding is Aham Brahmasmi. Everyone, there are many different schools of pursuits in the Vedas of transcendentalists. There's the Gyanis, there's the Bhaktas, there's the Yogis, all these different schools. But everybody at least agrees on this, huh? Aham Brahmasmi. I am spirit. That's what I am. The corollary, what we can immediately deduce from that is I am not matter. And then Prabhupada stated it in a very clear way, I am not this body. So we identify, our mistake is we identify the self with the material body. Also the mind is included in the body, the psychophysical complex that covers us. I am not the body. We have identified ourselves falsely with this material body. So although we are eternal, because I identify the self with the body, I think whatever happens to the body happens to me. And, you know, you can have fun with the body for a little while, but the long run trip is janma mrityu jara vyadhi, birth, old age, disease, and death. It is not nice. Well, we keep our illusions. The greatest ones always come from Hollywood, you know. You have the story, you know, there's an attractive young man, an attractive young girl, and they meet cute. They say, hi, they meet cute. They meet, and they fall in love. And then naturally there's some obstacle, some interference, some misunderstanding. They're separated from each other. The rest of the movie, they struggle, they get together, and finally, in so many interesting and clever ways, they overcome the obstacles, and they get together again, and they live happily ever after. They're finally together, and the music comes on at the end. They're walking hand in hand into the sunset, and the music's getting louder and louder. And says the end, and you say, yeah. Just keep the camera rolling, you know. Just keep it going. That's all you have to do, is don't stop there. The happy endings are a contrivance. So all these things are there to keep ourselves stupid, to distract us, to make us ignorant. There's so many ignorance industries. The whole entertainment industry is an ignorance industry. So you don't pay attention to what's really happening. So the television is and of course there's, you know, alcohol and all these different things that just lower our consciousness. So we don't see what happens. Unfortunately, when you lower your consciousness, you also are less alive. The other thing that soldiers in battle report, they never felt so alive. Although it was a horrible experience also for the first time, you know what I mean? Because it's, once you dull your consciousness, then you don't live your life. You know? You just live like a kind of a ghost. So when there's actually self-realization, then consciousness actually expands incredibly. And you actually understand, yeah, this is what it means to be alive. One of the things that happened. So we're not the bodies, we're spirit soul. When you say the self or the soul, what do you mean? Where is it? If it's not the body, and not the mind either, because in the West a lot of confusion was caused by people thinking the soul is the mind, which in the Vedas identify as the subtle body. So you get rid of all this mental phenomena, what's left? And the answer is consciousness. So people have claimed you can't experience the soul, it's just a kind of thing beyond all possible experience, and therefore really basically meaningless, no way to deal with it, or you just accept it on faith. But actually, the symptom of the soul, its presence, is consciousness. So not only do we experience the self or the soul, but actually the soul is the very condition for our having any experiences whatsoever. Just think about this for a minute. So the Vedas say, I'm not my body, I'm a spirit soul. Now there's a whole industry, you know, that wants to say there's no such thing as spirit. That there's only matter. This is a reductionistic way of looking at things. There's nothing but matter, and all we are is matter. They have a problem with consciousness. These people who want to do this, they really have a problem. And especially as part of a kind of scientific project. You know, science wants to deal with the world. So far as you could express it in terms of numbers. I mean, that's a very good thing to do. I mean, it's very useful. There's nothing wrong with it. So science really abstracts from our experience and only deals with quantity. How wide is it? How high is it? How fast is it? How slow is it? How hot is it? How cold is it? All these different things, you can put a number on it. And then you could do very interesting things. You get successful with that. And then you want to say, if you can't deal with it in terms of numbers, it doesn't exist. Or it's just not important whatsoever. So here's the story that we're told, that somehow in the beginning, there's very, very simple structures of matter that you can express it entirely in terms of numbers. You just have these structures of matter. And then these material structures, over the course of time, for some reason, start to get more complex, more complicated, more intricate. you know, those the story where there's subatomic particles and somehow they become atoms, and the atoms somehow they become molecules. And then the molecules get more complicated, and especially when there's carbon rings, then there's, you know, organic molecules. And so these structures get more and more complicated, and then life appears. Out of this. When that happens, what really they're saying is that what comes into existence now is not just structures of matter, but also the experience of structures of matter, living beings. Where does that come from? You see, if you have a universe and all there is structures of matter that get more complicated, that's all should happen. Where does this other thing pop into being, which is the experience of structures of matter? That's what we mean by consciousness. I simply mean the ability to undergo experiences. Or, to put it another way, to be a subject and not merely an object. In English philosophy, these terms are used. There's the subject that undergoes experiencing, and the objects are the things that the subject experiences. So here, this is my body, which is kind of a complicated structure of matter, taking up space in the room. And here, this laptop is also a complicated structure of matter, taking up space in this room. What's the difference? The difference is, I undergo experiences. Here in this structure, somebody is at home. Here, there's no one there. It's just a machine. Sometimes, cleverly, you could act like a human being, but there's no one having any experiences. So I am not just an object, I'm also a subject. I have significance for myself. This machine has only significance for others. So this experience, according to the Bhagavad Gita, this is an entity of another, in philosophical language, another ontological category. And you'll see in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that first of all, there's structures of matter. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, manas, buddhi, ahankara. His eight separated energies. Besides this, there's another energy, which is para, superior, which is jiva bhuta, all the souls, the living entities. And the whole world arises because these two energies come together. It is not that the souls come out of matter, it's that they flow together. And where do these two come from? They're both Krishna's energy, they come from Krishna. And then Krishna says, and beyond me, there's nothing more to be known. But that's what there is. There's matter, there's spirit, and there's the origin of both. This is the picture that Krishna gives. I think it deals far more adequately with our experience than any kind of thing. The material science is just trying to take one little part of this and say, well, we can explain it all. So this, by this understanding, we can now do something to actually gain this self-realization. That is to say, we've identified ourselves falsely with the material body. Well, first of all, one has to at least understand how this is possible. That I'm not my body, that I'm this consciousness, but I projected it into the body and the mind, and whatever happens to the body, I experience is happening to myself. But what do we do? How do we get rid of this false consciousness, this false identification of self? Therefore, we have to do something. Why do we identify with the material body? Well, because we have this desire to enjoy in the body. That's why any spiritual path that's serious about self-realization always ends up having some kind of asceticism. That's why in Krishna consciousness movement we have certain regular principles. And why there's we try to become free from what's called sense gratification. As soon as I try to enjoy these senses, it forces me to identify myself with the material body. People forget about that. You know, all our traditional religions and morality somehow limit or regulate our material enjoyment in certain ways. And because originally this is part of a whole product project of self-realization. What's happened is we've forgotten why. All we know, you know, there are these Ten Commandments, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Or something is being handed down from olden times with these restrictions. We don't know why they're there. We thought in the past there must have been these nasty old men, these patriarchs who didn't want anybody to have any fun. Who looked like the Ayatollah Khomeini or somebody, you know, this hate young people. And so for this reason, they put forth these life-denying, restrictive religions and moralities. And that's why we can't be happy, because we feel guilty and we have to break free from all this stuff. And this is the 60s. Big thing, you know, modern liberation movements all based on this kind of stuff. But there was a reason for this. That the problem is, well, Krishna says it very succinctly in the Bhagavad Gita, yehi samsparsa ja bhoga dukkayonaya evate. He says these pleasures which arise from the contact between the senses and the objects are in fact the cause of all suffering. So to unnecessarily engage in the pleasure of the senses causes our identification of the self with the material body. So what does that mean? When we identify with the material body, then we experience ourselves as growing old, as becoming diseased, as dying. So material enjoyment, the price we pay for these few cheap thrills, is death. In fact, sex is the cause of death. We turn to sex for life of affirming activities of reproduction and all these things, but actually, it's what causes our death. What we do to really solve our problem makes it worse. That's what Krishna is saying. The world is just the opposite of what we think. We think that we repeat these pleasures of the senses and, you know, we'll be happy. No, it's just the opposite. That's why people have recommended everywhere Buddha, Lao Tzu, from any tradition, this path of which there's some kind of control of the senses. That's necessary. Well, the other thing is that what's in the Bhagavad Gita is not just the negation of material sense activities, but the transfer, the direction of consciousness in a positive way to transcendence. One has to give oneself because we say this about the senses, that they're the cause of trouble. It's not the senses that are really the problem. It's how we're using them. And so what the Vedas ultimately teach is to give the senses spiritual objects. And that's what we do in the practice of Bhakti Yoga. We engage the tongue chanting Hare Krishna. We eat the food that's offered to Krishna. All these things actually, these practices work also to clear away this covering of illusion. That's actually just a simple, that's another thing that requires experience. When I first came to a Krishna temple myself, I was interested in spiritual life. I'd been studying different religions in the university. And I thought that I understood that material life is suffering. This is like I accepted what Buddha said as a kind of what all the religions were saying, what I thought was their highest level, that material life is suffering. He says the cause of our suffering are our desires. I could see that. Then he said one should extirpate, you know, uproot, destroy one's desires. Well, I tried. And I think I was not able to do anything. It was just impossible. So I just happened to have a friend who took me to a Hare Krishna temple. This is like 1960. Must have been 68. They had just shown up. I saw some chanting at our college and where I was in school. And I went to talk to a devotee. I was studying religion. You know, I was in a PhD program in religious studies, Religionswissenschaft. We started that in America. And so I thought, let me check this out. So I went to the temple like an anthropologist or something, and I'm not expecting much. But when the devotees started talking about giving the sense of spiritual engagement, it was just like a really new idea to me, even though I'd taken so many courses in Hinduism. He said it starts with the tongue. And anyway, to make a long story short, I bought a pair of japa beads, and somebody told me how to chant the Hare Krishna mantra. And I went home and I sat down and I chanted just to see what would happen. That's all. That was the extent of my faith that I was willing to try it, just to see what had happened. This was the age of experimentation in spiritual matters. And some of us had been taking some very powerful drugs just to see what would happen. So the beads seemed pretty harmless in comparison to the other things going around. So I chanted the Hare Krishna mantra just to see what would happen. Wasn't fireworks in my mind or anything that happened like you would get from some of these plants or other chemicals. But what did happen was that my material desires began to decrease. And I was really surprised that happened. In fact, it happened so fast that I wasn't quite sure I wanted them. I did want them to decrease, but maybe not so fast. I just stumbled on something that was really very powerful. And who were these people, and what is this chatting? And I had some. So I checked all these things out. You know, here I am still. Because it worked, and it was quite a process of discovery. I just couldn't believe. I mean, I was 3 years in postgraduate studies, studying religion, and how did these people who were jumping up and down in the street corner know so much more than I did? It was a humbling experience. But it was a practical process of self-realization. And so one can actually do this and see this thing work. Otherwise, you know, all you have are your illusions. And the time of death, all these illusions are shattered. You know, the masks come off and the curtain comes down. And so we have this capacity to do something real with our lives, to actually achieve a solution to all the problems in this world by this method. And unfortunately, the whole world is going, everything that people are doing to solve the problems of life are really making them worse. And so people's, but all these efforts to solve these sufferings, the things are going to increase. So it's the thing that we can do, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. And to actually deal with the janma mrityu jara vyadi, the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease, to really solve it. Okay. Any comments, questions? By hands? Yes?
Well, since we're talking about death.
Yeah.
I've got one big question. Like, devotees always have different points of views about what to really do at the moment of death. So, something like we should maybe think about your own deities or of the spiritual master, or chant the holy name, or some say you will not be able to think of what you want to think since there's this physical breakdown. You might not be able to concentrate on what you want.
Well, we know the general principle that one should quit one's body while remembering Krishna. How that's happened may not be the same for everybody. I myself would tend to pretty much rely on the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Of course, you see, everything we do is in a way a rehearsal for death. Death is a critical time. Whatever mentality Krishna explains is, of course, whatever state of mind is at the time of death, that will be our next birth. If we are absorbed in Krishna, we will not take birth in the material world, and we have material desires, and then we'll come back again. And we can come back again, you know, in all kinds of varieties of situations. So it's kind of like a final exam, and you should not go into this examination unprepared. And actually, we may think, well, okay, yeah, like death isn't going to be a problem for a while for me. Don't think like that. Prabhupada said old age means just before you die. So is there anyone who can say I am not old? Like any time. So, one should want to die while remembering Krishna. Devotees, it's very, very good to be in the company of devotees, especially with devotees who are chanting, reminding one of Krishna and in that association. That's what you do. Sometimes you can control it, sometimes you can't. I just had a disciple of mine, a woman in her 80s, was an extremely pious Christian, I mean really committed Christian, and she became a devotee. Strange, it was very odd for somebody, but when she became a devotee, she was in her 50s, and a really committed Christian, but she was just not satisfied with her own church. And when she encountered Krishna consciousness, we spent a lot of time talking about it. She could just recognize for what it was worth. Anyway, so she became a very, very serious devotee. And then she heard she was, she got colon cancer and it was terminal. She was living in Vrindavan, but she had to come back to the States. There was nobody there really to take care of her at this time. But anyway, it just so happened, she lived at a house not far from the temple, and so devotees were visiting her and so on, and it just really so happened that the time she left her body, I was in the room. It turned out about 14 other devotees showed up at the same time, and we were chanting, it's true, she was looking right at me when she left her body, but the interesting part, she was fully conscious, absolutely alert, and knew exactly what was going on. And there was the chanting, there was a spiritual master, that's the person that really reminds you of Krishna. And the Hare Krishna mantra is a form of Krishna, which is... And she was a person that used to chant all the time. It was just kind of constant chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. What I can say is that also in her case, that You know, it just happened. We keep making different kind of plans, but somehow or other, at that time, you don't know exactly, you know, everybody knew, well, this week maybe she's going to die, you know, but whom, everybody was there. I think that Krishna made that arrangement. What she wanted. I was supposed to be in Germany at that time, but everything got all messed up, and I was happened to be there. You know? These things go on. So just make plans to remember Krishna, the Hare Krishna mantra is the most condensed, portable form of Krishna that there is. You know, nothing else. Krishna is there, and I pretty much rely on that myself. But whatever really reminds you of Krishna, that's what you should do. You may not be able to see. You may not be able to. You can always chant.
Mm-hmm. I think if you try to do your best, so Krishna does everything for you. I mean, it's not like, you know, like there's some rules and regulations and they count it. If you don't have the rogue's course, then you can go in or like this. I think if you try your best, I mean, you have some conditions, you can do it. Mm-hmm. This level and not more, but it's the most what you can do, that Krishna is realized that you do your best and he organizes everything for you.
That's true.
Because, for example, I have a good explain with my grandmother. She was not believing in God like this, but she was a very good human being. Everybody likes her. And when she was dying, probably I got holiday and
you got what?
We have holiday, mm-hmm. and we visit because I'm from Hungary. Mm-hmm. So I was visiting with my husband, my parents, and when we come to the airport, my father told me, so we have very bad news, your grandmother is in a coma, it's probably she will die. So, and I was very happy because I can go to her and say goodbye to her. Mm-hmm. And Rama Sundara, it was also the luckiest thing. He had this 108 holy water mm-hmm. with him. And then when we go inside, so I really see that she's dying. So she's only, there was a body, it was not really my grandmother mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. And we can put some from this holy water, water on the head and in her mouth, and it was chanting a little bit Hare Krishna for her, and somehow she was not believing in God, but she was a good human being, and Krishna organized her that we are coming and chanting before she was dying, so the holy name for her, and
she left 5 hours later.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she had also a bath in the holy rivers. So, I mean, if God organized for somebody who is not even believing in him such a thing only because she is doing the right thing, that I think a devotee don't have to be afraid. Mm.
That's true because. You see, your grandmother's good fortune is that you're devotees.
Sort of.
Enough to have this happen.
You know? We tried.
There's many things that are not in control, and we can depend upon Krishna's mercy. But we should be careful about what we're attached to. Because if you're attached to anything, something other than Krishna, then the mind may go to that, and then you take birth in the material world.
That's true, but you said also we are eternal. So and Krishna is most merciful. So okay, maybe I failed in this life, But in the next life, he gives me a new chance, you know?
Yeah, that's true. You won't lose it all. That's true.
So we can lose it. So we have to try our best, and we can go back. And I mean, okay, maybe we have to have 10 births again more, but I mean, in compared to this 10 births with the eternity, it's nothing.
That's true. We see also, when the time of death comes by Krishna's mercy, people who have sometimes been very attached get detached, because they just see what, you know, everything that they've been maybe avoiding thinking about the material world, now you see it at all. You see, so these things that for a person who's not a devotee is an absolute disaster, is quite different from devotees. Because devotees, you know, when you're leaving and you see how everything is going away, you know, that just makes you get closer to Krishna, and so it's actually not you know, the worst thing or horrible or hopeless condition. A number of experiences. This is just like when this one lady Sharanagati was leaving her body. Sometimes there are people around who are not devotees, a hospice nurse or something like that, and they're really quite impressed by you know, the somebody dying to some purpose. Because, you know, most places they just try to, like, let's put this off in the corner and pretend it's not happened as much as possible, because for doctors it's the big defeat. You know, they've lost everything. And nobody really knows what it's for. It's just this horrible thing that happens at the end that makes everything meaningless. And let's just try to get over it and forget about it. Have another glass of wine. And then, you know. This is a much. People can see that it really changes the whole way you think about human life, and it's not just this anomaly at the end. It's really quite something that devotee is prepared for and ready for, and is really a part of our life, not just something against it. Okay, it's very good. Anything else? I guess people would like some prasadam.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of the night.
Well, we can do some 3 minutes of production.
I just have one question. Why is it when I was a little bit sick, I had some disease for more than 1 year, mm-hmm. my intestines and everything mm-hmm. was going better now, mm-hmm. and lost weight and everything, but I didn't have the feeling at that time that I was able to get more spiritual and to have a better spiritual life and to remember Krishna more. Mm-hmm. So, in opposite, when I feel good in my body, when I feel strength, mm-hmm. and I can say I love the life to mm-hmm. live, mm-hmm. and also have some kind of enjoyments, mm-hmm. I sometimes feel more connected and I feel more good feeling for Krishna mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. For all the other people. Mm-hmm. Open my heart is mm-hmm. even open, and then in comparison to the other situation, mm-hmm. why is it so?
Physical suffering is a big distraction. It really can do that. Really, of course, I've spent periods of time sick too, like you have, and it took some effort not to get distracted by the sickness and by the disease. And for me, what I really had to do was I had in some way just to say, this is a misfortune, but somehow or other, it is something that Krishna sent that I need to learn something from. As long as I treated this disease as a kind of meaningless thing that just happened for no reason, and I didn't accept it as Krishna's mercy. Like, why should Krishna's mercy be like this? But once I did, there must be something that Krishna wants me to learn from this that I couldn't learn any other way. What is it? And then I began to see it as something positive. And once I accepted it as Krishna's mercy, I began to see how I could use it for my spiritual advancement. So that was the hard thing to do at first, because really, I couldn't see how it was Krishna's mercy. I just couldn't see how it was Krishna's mercy. But I just decided it had to be. So this is what we call surrender sometimes. You just do it even though you don't know why. But then everything changed. I mean, everything... It did like that. And but I think, I hope you don't have to go through this again, but if you do...
Okay, I understand.
Say it's Krishna's mercy. That's my suggestion.
Okay. So, I have two questions, but I suppose they're long ones, so perhaps for tomorrow. You explained today how does the material thing doesn't work. So this expectation that material happiness will make me happy or... Mm-hmm. So, I would like to ask you to explain tomorrow how the other thing works. How the spiritual life works, and specifically how the Mahamantra works.
Okay, yeah, we can talk about that tomorrow. We're going to be at your place, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. If you want to hear, come. I guess we could use it. That is a lot of them. So you want to know tomorrow, so this is what we'll talk about tomorrow, how Krishna consciousness or the spiritual energy works, or spiritual life works.
And fulfills this, what we are failing here. So how does the opposite work? This material
doesn't work.
Doesn't work. So how does?
How's the opposite work? Okay. All right. We'll talk about that.
Maybe we can do some 2 minutes of bhajan and offer the gilas quickly.
What is this? What is it? It's a little machine.